This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It's great privilege to travel to the Caribbean, sitting at my desk, with Professor Abbott Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. I do not know these states, nor how many there are. I do know Cuba. And right now, Cuba remains a threat to itself and to the region. The headline in Reuters, 3 days hence, top U.S. diplomat in Havana promises more sanctions on Cuba. Three Cuban judges and a prosecutor were forbidden from entering the United States on Wednesday, the latest sanctions from the Trump administration, which earlier declared a tough new policy on Cuba. Professor, Cuba is in the portfolio of adversaries of the United States, chiefly Moscow, but we cannot rule out Beijing having an increasing voice in Cuba. And then there are the bad actors in the region that are welcome, who are welcome in Havana, to my understanding, or have been over the years. That would be Caracas and Managua, certainly. So we're looking at a hostile or extremely anarchic land. The U.S. sanctions, what is your measure over the years? Have they been effective? Because they've become a debating point in the Cuban-American community.
John, the sanctions certainly have had impact, although it's also useful to recall that Cuba's had many different options from European and other tourism. But really, you've seen an oscillation in the sanctions. There was a clampdown, of course, during the first Trump administration following the dramatic lifting of many of the sanctions previously under Barack Obama. Some, but not all of that was lifted under the Biden administration. And now with the current chief of missions, Mike Heimer, who came in about 6 months ago, talking about more sanctions to come. But under these sanctions, what you have seen is problems largely due to Cuba's government mismanagement of the economy more than sanctions themselves, causing an increasing collapse. That collapse led to, in 2021, unexpected pushback by Cubans against the regime, which was basically crushed through detentions. Since that time, you've seen about a million Cubans leave in various different ways through the Caribbean to the rest of the region. You've also seen progressive signs of the collapse of the Cuban economy. So blackouts are getting worse, which reflects the fact that they have not put capabilities to maintain their power system. So every time you have a minor storm or something like that, they will lose power. Right now, you have essentially programmed blackouts throughout the island, which can be as long as 15 hours a day in some parts of the countryside, a little bit less in Havana. The GDP last year shrunk by about 1.9%. So Cuba is really in a dire state, however, that does not keep the absolute control of the Cuban Communist Party from maintaining itself in power despite that deterioration. Also, as you pointed out, it is a reminder of the fact that Cuba is a host to a variety of different threats. You had, of course, Cuba just last year receiving a Russian military group, including the nuclear submarine Kazan and the missile frigate Admiral Gorshkov, reminding of the role that Cuba plays there. You have a very important CSIS report that came out a couple months ago, focusing on the operation by China of one and perhaps as many as four different electronic intelligence facilities from Cuba, focused on the United States. Cuba has previously met and talked about business dealings with the Iranian regime. And so, the sanctions don't seem to be getting this regime change. They do seem to be limiting Cuba's capability. However, it's a reminder that Cuba not only is a danger to its own people, that the regime there of Miguel Díaz-Canel, but also continues to be a strategic risk for the United States, a threat host of Russians, Chinese, Iranians, and various others. And so, remembering the story going back to 1961, important to keep an eye on what's going on in this island nation very close to the U.S. maritime southeast approaches.
Mr. Obama, toward the end of his second term, traveled to Havana, and I believe I recall him attending a baseball game with the younger Castro brother. Did that come to anything today? Was there a change in atmosphere after that outreach by the president?
Well, John, when Barack Obama first came into the presidency, one of the things that he promised was a new look at Cuba, saying that the previous legacy of strong U.S. sanctions had not brought about regime change. And so what Obama did was, beginning in about 2014, with secret negotiations, try to renegotiate an opening. Now, after Obama's time, even with Joe Biden, there was a broad sense that the concessions that had been given in terms of economic access and the ability to travel to Cuba again, reestablishment of diplomatic relations, had gotten very little with respect to the rights or freedom of Cubans or changes in Cuban behavior with respect to Venezuela or the rest of the region. And so, again, not only President Trump, when he came to power the first time, but even Joe Biden, when he came to power, really did not go back to what came to be seen as some of those failed concessions of the Obama policy. And so the difficulty is that, Cuba seems locked into a certain pattern of how it's going to govern the country and how it's going to act in the region. Taking advantage of the moments when the United States tries to ease up on it a little bit and hunkering down in the moments when the United States, as is currently the case, appears set on clamping down and restricting what Cuba can do and its resources.
Cuba in the Caribbean and the Caribbean in general, because I asked the professor, help me understand, there are 13 sovereign states in the Caribbean. Is that correct, Professor?
That's correct, John. Depending on how you count, you have 13 sovereign states, and then you have other states which are, for example, in the case of Bonaire, Aruba, Curaçao, St. Martin, Saba, St. Eustace, are considered in one way or another part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. You have others, Guadeloupe and San Martin, that are part of the French government as overseas territories, and you have others that are in other limited foreign policy making capability, but lots of sovereign states that vote at the Organization of American States states that frankly, again, comprise what is the strategically important U.S. Southeast maritime approach, which in time of war, if we were ever at war with China, would be a very important territory. It is, of course, a center of logistics for the United States and indeed for the northeast of South America. It's an area that, despite its strategic importance, is tremendously under different types of threats and stresses. You have in places like Trinidad and Tobago and in Jamaica a confluence of gun violence, gangs, and drug violence, for those drugs transiting to the United States, but also drugs that are coming out of Colombia, Venezuela, transiting to Europe. You have, as we've talked about before, a strong presence of China, not only in ports and in tourist projects, but also with military relationships and even, electronic intelligence collection, as we saw in Cuba. You have, some presence, as we saw before, with the Russian military visit of the Russians. You have oil assets, as you look to the south of the Caribbean, in Guyana and Suriname, as well as Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago, as we've talked about before. And so from oil and foreign actors and violence, there's a lot going on. If that were not enough, John, the region is in a process of unprecedented political transition. Literally, and I'll give you the list that I've got. Literally, this past year, we've had elections in Bermuda, Turks and Caicos, Curacao, and of course, just in Suriname, as well as Trinidad and Tobago and Belize, which is on the Central American coast of the Caribbean. In the coming months alone, we're going to see some critical elections in Guyana, Jamaica, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Anguilla, Honduras, which again is on the Central American coast. And then in early 2026, you're going to see elections in Costa Rica, Bahamas, St. Lucia, and Colombia. And so this strategically vital region with a lot of challenges. It is in a state of unprecedented political transition and trying to deal with those challenges.
The reason I'm keen on the Caribbean in general is that one of the nations contributing to the chaos in the whole hemisphere is Venezuela. So I give you headlines from Venezuela, but mostly what I want to know about is the oil. On again, off again, oil exploitation. For example, Juan Pablo Guanipa, The opposition leader close to Maria Corina Machado is now under arrest for allegedly leading a terrorist plot. This comes upon the news that the Maduro party has retained control of the legislature. Does any of this connect with the oil decision on again, off again? And where are we in Venezuela's ability to both extract the oil and ship it?
Well, John, you alluded to Venezuela literally, this past weekend had a symbolic vote for different localities. It was had relatively low participation, as was expected with the opposition choosing largely not to participate. The Venezuelan, the ruling Maduro party, at least officially won 83%. So they continue with control of Congress and things like that. So the outcome of the vote, unsurprisingly, is that the Maduro dictatorship, which had also robbed the presidency very flagrantly last July 28th, continues to consolidate its power. But with respect to the oil piece of it, you have really what's been a deteriorating situation of oil production because the unwillingness of actors like Halliburton and Schlumberger and others to be there. And yet you've had some continuing oil production, about 800,000 barrels per day, despite a history of sanctions. Previously, the Biden administration had authorized the U.S. company Chevron to continue oil production, as well as the European companies Repsol and Eni. And the Trump administration had allowed some of those things to continue, apparently in part based on some negotiations that had gone on from President Trump's special representative, Rick Grenell. Now, the Chevron piece of that, which accounts for about a quarter of all of Venezuela's oil production, was up for grabs. The end of its special license to continue to do that expired at the end of this month. And so there was some last minute drama regarding whether that license would be extended for a while longer. Indeed, it appeared that Rick Grenell had said something about that extension taking place. But then Marco Rubio, our Secretary of State, who as Secretary of State should know what the official policy is, said, no, the license is going to expire. So it appears there may be some now extra a license to allow Chevron to at least keep its operations, keep the lights on there in Venezuela. But the end of the Chevron license will take a little bit of the Venezuelan oil off the table. And again, at the end of the day, it comes down to the question of, you know, will other actors, the Russians, the Chinese, the taking of oil through, essentially smuggled operations paid for by cryptocurrencies and things like that, will all of those dirty tricks be enough to keep the Venezuelan oil industry limping along for quite some, for quite some time? And the answer is probably yes. So Venezuela is weakened, but it continues to get enough oil revenue on top of the revenue from things like illicit gold and taxing remittances activities such as taxing the drug flows that go through its territory for the Maduro administration to remain solvent and continue to create problems with its neighbors in the region.
We're going to find good news. This is the Latin American concentration in the New World Report. When we come back, first, a concern about Mexico and an election underway or about to be, and then the happy result of the election in Ecuador with Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.